This evening I want to explore, with your help, the theme of integrity and how this relates to our practice. And I want to explore that theme in significant part by continuing the way of connecting our spiritual practice with the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King, which I did last week, in the context of the challenges of our times. So that's the larger map. Right, so one, the focus is on the nature of integrity, and I'll bring in both examination of our own lives and looking at the life of Dr. King to explore that theme. So I think I want to first begin by just saying a word or two about integrity. It has to do, I think, with the wholeness of our lives, with the way that our deeper values and principles, what matters most to us, is there in all the parts of our lives, not just in some of them. And for many of us, there can be challenges when we value certain principles or ways of being, and we develop it in some parts of our lives, and then we realize that we're not living with integrity in another part of our lives. Or maybe we think we're living by a certain principle, and then we do something, or something happens, and we wonder, am I really living with integrity? So integrity has to do with consistency, with wholeness, the wholeness of our lives representing what most matters. The Christian philosopher and writer C.S. Lewis said, integrity is doing what's right even when no one is looking. I'd like to ask you just to reflect, just for yourself for a moment, what's been a learning experience for you in which you learned to live with greater integrity? I just want to invite you to reflect silently on your own for a minute or two. What's been an experience of yours in which you learned to live with greater integrity? And again, it may be because you found yourself not in integrity with something, and then it was a kind of corrective. So just reflect on that for a moment. And see if you could, if you'd be willing to share with the group, which is not at all necessary, I'll just ask for a few people, could you bring your learning into one or two sentences that would express it? Not always so easy, but see if you can formulate your learning about integrity in one or two sentences. Yeah, why don't we use the mic, and I'll ask just for a few people to respond. Again, try to keep it to one or two sentences so we can have time for a few people. We also say our name as we're speaking.
I think in learning to be honest with myself, mm-hmm. not delude myself,
yeah.
and justify things, but to be honest with myself and wanting to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And not kidding myself anymore.
Yeah, so kind of radical honesty with oneself. Yeah. And we'll bring the mic over here.
So this is something I'm struggling with. Speaking up about my values, especially when they're attached to my feelings,
mm-hmm.
Even though somebody else may not want to hear them, and then having the willingness to take the blowback from that.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking up about what's important for oneself, even when the situation is such that you might get something coming at you, negativity, what you were calling blowback. How many can relate to that as something important for you in terms of integrity? And how many of you can relate to that point about learning to be more honest with oneself as part of integrity? Yeah. Thanks. A few others? Anyone like to share? It may be for some people a stretch in your integrity to speak up.
This is a rather simple point.
Yeah.
But I was hiking along this area, and it's a place I go every day, and I receive cigarettes there, butts there from either the fishermen or teenagers who come there at night and smoke.
Yeah.
And I walk by and get angry every time I saw it. And finally, I just stopped one day and picked it up. I didn't have to be angry anymore because I stopped and did something instead of just being angry about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So learning how to work with anger and act in a way so you don't just keep the irritability, resentment within. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How many can relate to that? It's something you've also come to learn. Yeah. Yeah. Anyone else like to speak? Lucy and Beck, and then.
When I was about 10, 11, my brother caught me in a old lace lie. He didn't punish me, but taught me not to lie again.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still struggle with the little white lies, or white deceptions, but I really learned.
Yeah, so
from my mom.
Learning about the value of being truthful. Yeah. And how many people have had some situation in which you had a habit maybe of not telling the truth, or it could be of whatever, stretching the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And as it were caught, or someone, or you found yourself revealed and learn something from that experience. How many can relate to that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully that can happen in the public realm in the next months.
You have to recognize it first.
Yeah, yeah. Please.
If I think back, the process of learning how to have more correct, right speech,
yeah,
involved a process of awareness and developing clarity and maturity and a lot of different factors. But I think if I look at how I've evolved in terms of having the right speech, I think part of it had to do with really wanting to be in integrity,
yeah,
because I expected that of others. And so I think I've come a long way with that.
Yeah. Yeah, so speech is particularly a place where we may not be in integrity and where we can work on it. That's actually been central to almost everyone. You know, whether it's the internal speech that we say to ourselves, or the speaking in a difficult situation. But that speech is this very crucial place where integrity plays out. So, anyone else really wanted to add? I can take one more if someone was wanting to speak and didn't have a chance. Sarah, please.
The first precept, which is non-harming, I think it's sort of a continuing, ongoing exploration.
Yeah.
And then I totally agree that right speech remains a huge area of continued focus and interest.
Yeah. So really taking seriously some of the ethical principles that one says one's living by, such as non-harming and speaking skillfully, and then sometimes asking really hard questions, or basically just having it in mind and saying, oops, did I just do that? Okay. And again, the spirit of the practice is not one of blaming or judging or punishing oneself. It's more the spirit of a training where we know, and this is important for integrity, we know that we're always imperfect. And we can see it more as a training where we keep learning. And so actually seeing where we fall short is very positive. It's not the cause for judging or being negative or blaming, but it can be the cause even for some joy. Oh, look what I learned. Now that's a hard one, because I know I was raised somewhat to want to be good and perfect. Does anyone else have this particular upbringing? And so I remember there's a very important point where I learned that if I was always perfect, I was never going to learn anything. And of course, I wasn't perfect. I just wanted to be, right? And a certain boy said, my gosh, if I'm always perfect, that means I'm never going to learn anything, and I'm just going to, you know, stay where I am. And I could see the absurdity of the wish to be perfect. Yeah. Did you want to share?
No, I was going to say the same. Just the regret that you feel when you haven't acted in integrity is really...
Noticing regrets, you know. So noticing some regret. There's actually a phrase in Buddhist teachings that has been very extremely underdeveloped in Western ways of interpreting Buddhism, which is usually translated as inner remorse. And it's actually a key term in the Buddhist teachings. We don't hardly teach it at all, but it has to do with actually feeling like one has come short with one's commitments, one's principles, and that there is actually some remorse, which is not the same as being hard on oneself. It's not the same as being judgmental. It's actually something which is coming from the yearning, I think, to be in integrity, to be in wholeness. And I know for myself, this challenge has been there all my life, but I think the goal of integrity was there, I think, from a young age. And when I was reflecting on my own experiences, I reflected some, what first came to mind is knowing that my my father, who was a scientist, he was working for the government at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland. And the salary wasn't real big, you know. I remember that because 1 year we had a broken television set for an entire year before it got repaired. And I think it was because it was just finances were a little tight. And so he was approached by drug companies who wanted him to be their employee, and he would make 3 or 4 times the amount of money. But he would be essentially using his scientific knowledge to develop drugs for the purposes of making, as we know, large sums of money. And he didn't think necessarily always even beneficial. But it was tempting, as you might imagine, to be offered a salary 3 times what you're getting. And, you know, I remember being, whatever, a teenager, I think, maybe even younger, and thinking it was pretty cool that he didn't take those jobs, and I could live with the broken TV set. Because my parents still had limits of 1 hour a day anyway, so with the TV. So anyway, that came to mind. And then I also was reflecting on a few other examples. One also concerned speech. I remember when I was first meditating and I had a close friend, we shared practice a lot together. And one day she told me, Donald, or I think I was called Donnie at that point, Donnie, you really don't follow right speech particularly, you know? And I was, but then when I looked at it, I had to agree. And it was like something lit up in me and say, I want to pay attention to speech. I want to pay attention to how I speak and have it be consistent with my deeper values, you know, which the teachings and practices on skillful speech give us. So I can remember that spark and that yearning to have a sense of integrity. And also very much, you know, as I was studying meditation, I came originally from a background when I was younger, when I was starting as a teenager, when I was really interested in social change and social justice. And my parents were quite involved with that. And I had been very involved, but then when I discovered meditation, it opened up something, an inner realm that I didn't know about, really. And it was incredibly powerful to explore a quiet mind, a silent mind, what happens when one practices for a period of time. I did a lot of retreats right when I first learned about meditation. You know, many, many retreats. I was in my 20s. And it just was totally revelatory. At a certain point, it was important for me to connect that with what I had done earlier related to social change and so forth. To have integrity, in other words, to have them come together. And that, at the time, was hard. It's like when I went to my old social change buddies, they were not interested in spirituality or meditation. You know, they thought, you know, good Lord, you know, what are you doing? You know, and then the people in meditation, they didn't seem to have the horizon of wanting to connect the meditation with acting out in the world, being in the world and working for justice and so forth, and not even paying much attention to our communities. And so for a long time, it was actually kind of lonely, because I had this vision of wholeness or of integrity, and I didn't know how it was going to manifest, because I'd be in these two communities and there'd be something really valuable in each of them, but I didn't know how to bring it together. You know, I didn't know how to make the connection. And there weren't people, even hardly anyone there who was interested in that connection, but it felt like I needed to honor my wish for wholeness, for integrity, for having both of these together. And so I wanted to connect this discussion with some of where we looked at last time, because I was interpreting that there's a kind of a common core of our spiritual practice and of what we find with the life and work of Dr. King and the aspirations towards nonviolent social change, both of which are rooted in the aspiration to bring love and wisdom and awareness to every moment of our lives and every part of our lives. And I interpreted our Buddhist practice, mindfulness and loving kindness and so forth, in that way, that we really are wanting to have our lives be whole and every moment be guided by our ethical principles, by our being able to be aware, mindful, wise, coming from a kind heart. And a lot of the really powerful parts of our practice are when we find our edges of growth. You know, so it's a theme that we have explored a lot here, which is how do you bring your practice to various kinds of difficult situations? How do you bring your practice when there are difficult emotions, difficult thoughts, the judgmental mind, negative scenarios, interpersonal difficulties, conflicts, right? Very crucial theme for our practice and a very alive theme, right? Because, you know, we have a general model of training where we start, where we can develop some of our core qualities like mindfulness and loving kindness and wisdom in protected environments. And we develop them, and we really, that's the nature of training. We develop these qualities, like an evening like tonight, you know, hopefully supportive for developing the qualities, both through the meditation and then through the understanding. And then we're invited to bring this to our lives, right? And we have a really a quest to do that. And we could hear that in a lot of the accounts of how to develop more integrity. A lot of them were focused around speech, right? And we can really look at that. We can really look at that aspiration for wholeness. I think that's the center of our practice, really. And, you know, where I think Dr. King's work is particularly important is in seeing that wholeness being brought also to the social realm. So it's very similar to my quest that, you know, we may remember that you know, Dr. King originally was committed to Christian spiritual practice. For him, it was centered around love. And he also was growing up at a time when the racial injustice was blatant, and, you know, even more blatant than it is now. And yet he didn't know how to really bring those together originally. He later said that in his studies, it was only when he studied Gandhi that he had a sense that the love ethic of Jesus, which was for him the guiding practice, following that love ethic, could be brought to the social world and to issues of injustice. Prior, he said, to reading Gandhi, he thought that love was only appropriate in one's personal relationships, interpersonally and maybe in terms of oneself. And so he followed this innovation of Gandhi. It's very relevant for our practice, because when we look to what we get from the Buddhist tradition, the ancient Buddhist tradition, we get something very similar to what King got. That is, a sense of practice which is most developed in terms of meditation and to some extent our interpersonal relationships, how we are face to face with others. And generally the Indian traditions of that time and for quite some time after didn't really have a way, didn't really have a horizon of bringing it to the issues of a larger society. You know, in some ways, that's something which primarily develops in later times in the West. You know, you had theories of government, but they all related to the rulers. There wasn't really a place for everyday people to engage. And so Gandhi innovated. He took the models of his time. I think, as we saw some last week, he took the models of his tradition, the principles of non-harming and the principles of what was called karma yoga, or the work and action as a spiritual path, and he brought that in an innovative way into the struggle for independence, motivated and inspired in large part by an American import. He got that originally from Henry David Thoreau, writing about civil disobedience up in Massachusetts during the time of the Mexican-American War in the 1840s, right? So Gandhi imports Henry David Thoreau from America, and then Dr. King imports Gandhi from India back to America. Interesting, isn't it? So it's important because I think for us, we may not have a clear sense of how to bring our meditative practice into the larger world, right? We don't get that with the traditional teachings, right? And this is where I think King plays such a large role, because he was making that bridge. And particularly through working with Gandhi, he could make a bridge between the inner work that one does and the outer expression. You know, and I've often identified the shared principle that permits that kind of integrity or wholeness as that of the teaching of the two arrows, or the teaching which says that when there is pain, I will not simply react and contract to that pain. That the teaching of the two arrows, which is the one that where the Buddha says, everyone experiences the unpleasant. How is a mature practitioner different from someone who's not practicing? Just anyone off the street, so to speak. And he said, everyone experiences the unpleasant physical sensations, unpleasant emotions, thoughts, interpersonal relationships, injustice, etc. Everyone experiences that at times. But he said, when you don't have this guiding spiritual principle, one simply reacts to the unpleasant. You tighten at the level of the body. You tighten, contract. With emotions, one contracts. Maybe you blame yourself, you blame others. There's reactivity. With someone with interpersonal relationships, someone does something negative to me, I do something negative right back to the other person. You know, I may do that, or maybe if I'm of the personality that simply says, I must be wrong, I judge myself. But there's some kind of reaction towards oneself or others. That's called shooting the second arrow. And the teaching is, we learn not to shoot the second arrow. We learn not to be reactive. And again, I've interpreted in a very simple way the core of the whole Buddhist teachings as learning to be responsive rather than reactive. Very simple words, but it actually is very profound. It means being free and not being bound by habits and reactivity. Right? So I've interpreted the nonviolence of Gandhi and King as precisely a version of this teaching. That is, we have received pain, we have received oppression, we will not simply turn around and inflict pain on those who gave us pain. We will not inflict violence on those who gave us violence. Do you see how that is very, very similar? As a, if not the same, teaching. And so, how to bring that into, how to have the integrity of bringing these principles into all the parts of our lives. Now, I wanted to point particularly in terms of our asking about integrity to a time in Dr. King's life. You could say that the whole of his life was an attempt to have the wholeness or the integrity of these principles of love, I would say, and wisdom, of seeing interconnection, of bringing love to all beings. And they're magnificent examples. And he was also quite imperfect. You know, we know about his affairs, right? We know that he was, he was an amazing being, and many people think of him as the major moral and spiritual figure, or the most important figure in our history, right? Which I tend to agree with. But he had imperfections. There were ways he fell short. There were ways he did not have integrity. And he probably would be the first to admit that, right? And yet there was this questing for integrity. And I wanted to bring up one example of that. You know, again, you could say that the whole of his life was about having the principle of love be in every part of his life. But there was a point in the middle 1960s, right? He died in 1968, born in 1929. He only lived 39 years. There was a point at which he was grappling with whether to say anything about the Vietnam War. And he knew that if he did so, there would be a lot of consequences, a lot of them negative, right? Some of you probably saw that recent film on Dr. King's life. What was that called? Selma, was that it? Mm-hmm. I think Selma. And in that film, you see his relationship to President Johnson, right? And there was a fairly, you know, collaborative relationship that was going on. And yet here was President Johnson expanding this war in Vietnam. And King had primarily stressed civil rights for his entire life, even though we know from looking at his journals and his early writings that he was actually quite interested in issues of war and peace. But he focused on so-called civil rights issues. He knew that if he turned his attention to Vietnam, there would be hell to pay, so to speak, both in terms of becoming persona non grata with the White House, probably most of the politicians, and getting a lot of criticism from within his colleagues in the civil rights movement. And when he did speak up, those all happened. You know, he was isolated. At the end of his life, he had a very, very high disapproval rating from both the population as a whole and even from within the African-American community, below 50% in the African-American community, primarily because of the stand. So I wanted to play an excerpt from the speech at which he broke silence about Vietnam. This is a famous speech at the Riverside Church in New York on April 4th, 1967, 1 year to the day before he was assassinated. And I'll play just the first few minutes of the speech where he talks about his own grappling with how to live in integrity. And I wanted to play that, and then I'll go a little further, and then we'll open things up. Okay? So why don't you help with the volume? Hopefully we have a good volume. So this is Dr. King right at the beginning of the speech.
Welcome to this magnificent house of worship tonight.
A lot louder.
Because my conscience leaves me no other choice.
It's the one on the right.
I join you in this meeting because I'm in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization which has brought us together, clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal, and that time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do, in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. But we must move on. And some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak. And we must rejoice as well For surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movements and pray that our own inner being may be sensitive to its guidance, for we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us. Over the past 2 years, as I have moved to break the betrayal of my own silences and to speak from the burnings of my own heart, as I have called for radical departures from the destruction of Vietnam, many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. At the heart of their concerns, this query has often loomed large and loud. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. Aren't you hurting the cause of your people, they ask. And when I hear them, though I often understand the source of their concern, I'm nevertheless greatly saddened. For such questions mean that the inquirers have not really known me, my commitment or my calling. Indeed, their questions suggest that they do not know the world in which they live. In the light of such tragic misunderstanding, I deem it of signal importance to try to state clearly, and I trust concisely, why I believe that the path from Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, the church in Montgomery, Alabama, where I began my pastorate, leads clearly to this sanctuary tonight. I come to this platform tonight to make a passionate plea to my beloved nation.
The day after his speech, the New York Times had an editorial completely criticizing him. And numerous African American leaders spoke up and said he was in error. So you can hear that aspiration for integrity and the willingness to be with a very challenging situation and come forth. I wanted to offer that in large part to have us be able to inquire, what does integrity mean for me? And particularly, what does it mean for me in this time? You know, where is my edge of growth around integrity? How do we find integrity at the sort of the level we might call intrapsychic, or the inner person, which was one of the areas brought out, the inner honesty? How do we find integrity interpersonally? And a lot of our practices can help with that, and really can help with both seeing where we fall short and seeing how to develop. You know, and I've been very interested in the challenges in Western Buddhist settings of having a life of integrity, because in many ways I've questioned and not been entirely comfortable with the degree of emphasis on meditation. Obviously, I love meditation, but there's a way in which, in the way that recent Western Buddhism and Western spirituality has developed, that it's been very, very focused on meditation. And so we have sitting groups, right? We have groups where we meditate. And again, there can be some focus on daily life. But in terms of the training, there's not always, I think, the level of depth with daily life practice that we might have with retreat practice. That's my own analysis. And I can understand it, why that's the case historically, because there is a way in which the inner dimension of Western religions has largely been lost in the last few hundred years. Actually, going back more like close to 1,000 years. You know, and it's only, you only find contemplative traditions in the West in very rare places. You know, like I go to visit the Abbey of Gethsemane, where Thomas Merton was a monk. I go there every year. That's one of the places. But by and large, Western religion had become something more ritualistic, more focusing on sometimes very helpful teachings, but lacking sometimes that inner contemplative and even mystical dimension that many of us found resonant with Buddhist practice. And so it's very understandable that we would go in that direction, but there hasn't always been the emphasis on how to bring it into all the parts of our lives. So I think it is, there is an issue of integrity with even how Western Buddhism has developed. And I'm, you know, my own personal edge is how to make this real in daily life. You know? And so I think there, again, there's the interpersonal dimension, and then there's the social dimension, which is, again, can be very challenging. We don't necessarily have a lot of clear guidance from ancient Buddhist tradition. We have a little bit more from the movements that have been called engaged Buddhism. We can have some guidance from teachers like Gandhi and King and others. But how do we bring integrity into our way of relating to the larger social world? Not easy, right? Especially with the developments occurring now. How do we have integrity? How do we face what's occurring? I think maybe many of us are asking that. There was a wonderful set of questions asked by the great African-American writer, sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois. Towards the end of his life, when he was 89 years old, he started on the writing of 6 novels. Three novels. 89 years old, he says, I am inspired to write 3 novels. Amazing, right? Amazing. And in the first novel, in the middle of the novel, he asks 4 questions, which are about integrity in the midst of difficult situations. And I'll just give you these questions. How does integrity face oppression? Question number 1, how does integrity face oppression? Number 2, what does honesty do in the face of deception? What does honesty do in the face of deception? Number 3, what does decency do in the face of insult?
Could you repeat those?
What does decency do in the face of insult? And how does virtue meet brute force? How does virtue meet brute force? He was articulating these in the late 1950s. How does integrity face oppression? What does honesty do in the face of deception? What does decency do in the face of insult? And how does virtue meet brute force? Powerful questions, aren't they? And I think I want to suggest these questions and the theme of integrity really as a horizon of our practice. It's not like we have to get it perfect, but can I raise the question of integrity and see where it comes up in my life? How much does it come up in my life just in the way I understand myself? Am I deceiving myself? You know, how do I talk to myself? Am I fooling myself? Do I have integrity in my own consciousness? And probably, if you're anything like me, there are shortcomings there. How do I have integrity interpersonally? And if you're anything like me, there are shortcomings there. How do you have integrity in facing the larger social world? And if you're like anything like me, there are shortcomings there. I could almost have a chant together. But I'm speaking for myself. But so the invitation is to look more carefully and to see that this is actually a deep aspiration of our practice. The practice is not just about being quiet and calm in certain parts of our life and peaceful. It's about integrity in all the parts of our lives. And, you know, when I've met people from other continents, you know, and I remember in the 1980s, I was involved with some international gatherings. I met people who were liberation theologians from Latin America. I remember particularly meeting a man named Enrique Dussel, who was one of the prominent writers. And he said something which was echoed by people I met in Thailand. He said that their fears were that the kind of the spiritual movements in the U.S., and for the people in Thailand, this was particularly Buddhist tradition, could easily be co-opted by middle-class escapism. They were concerned about that. You know, the people in Latin America and the people in Asia, they could see that possibility happening. So how do you live in integrity? How do we live in integrity? Recognize that as a tension. You know, for people, you know, the majority of people doing insight meditation, if I could say so, have fairly privileged lives. You know, how do we live in integrity? I pass on the inquiry to all of us together. Thank you. So we have about 10 minutes or a little bit more for any comments, questions. Patty, please. Let's use the microphone.
Thank you for this. It was very moving and very brought up a lot.
Yeah.
I share your past situation of wanting to blend two communities, where your spiritual community and your activist community were on the same page.
Yeah.
I'm part of a vegan community, have been for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I felt like I had found my people when I discovered meditation that wished wellness to all living beings, omitting none, the great and the mighty, the short and small. I've taken on the Mem Sutta, I've memorized it, and I thought, I found my people. Everyone gets it. This is going to be a vegan community because they honor all living beings. And I see also a disconnect between the words of the Mem Sutta and the teachings that I get from the Buddhist community, and the absence of consciousness around eating, and the billions of beings that are harming. Anyway, I helped to found an organization called Dharma Voices for Animals that tries to bring together those two worlds.
Yeah.
But it's a very lonely place.
Yeah.
I mean, we have dozens of teachers from the West and from the East, four members. Tara Brock just joined. A lot of teachers have joined us, but the vast majority of teachers and lay people in the West don't pay any attention to that. Hurts me. So I understand that feeling of wanting to blend the two communities and trying to bring the practice to all aspects of life. And like you, I fall short in many, many areas. But I'm just doing my best to live in integrity in terms of taking the first precept and integrating it into daily practice. So thank you for bringing this up. I totally love the speech that you shared, and the invitation to look at those questions, because in these times and in all times, those are crucial issues.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Patty, and thank you for sharing your own story of you know, finding your own integrity, and then having challenges with. Wanting to share that with, you know, wanting to have that the integrity which you feel shared by this other community. Yeah. And, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello.
Hey.
I'm Will.
Yeah, I will.
Good to meet you. I really enjoyed what you had to say.
Yeah.
That very powerful. There's a couple of things that really stuck to me. The last three novels of W.E.D.
Du Bois, yeah.
Du Bois. Those questions are very powerful, and I find I run into questions like that on a daily basis, trying to see how to handle tough situations with integrity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's huge, especially for myself. And also what you said about trying to combine two worlds, because I also feel that, I won't get into specifics, but it's really tough when you see the benefits of both worlds and how combining them would be such a big force and would help everyone on the planet. And it's tough to go about the right way of doing that without kind of seeming like a know-it-all.
Right. Yeah, and very, yeah, so I think we're pointing to some of the challenges of integrity, you know, that it can feel lonely. You know, I certainly can relate to that. And still feel, you know, I still feel in many of the contexts in which I am, I feel somewhat lonely, and I don't feel necessarily like people know me in certain ways. And that's not easy, right? You know, it's like, and I imagine that's the case, Will, also, that, you know, when you're trying to bridge things and, some people may be oblivious of one world, that, in a sense, means they don't really know you, right? And so there's that quality of, it can be loneliness. And yet what keeps us going when that's occurring? And maybe sometimes we don't want to keep going with that. You know, I just want to, it's hard, it's too hard. But what keeps one going, I think, is that inner impulse towards more integrity. You know, and then there's that, you know, the question of how do you relate? I think, again, I think it kind of implied by what you were saying is how do you not become know-it-all with your language? How do I not think I'm better than them and judge them? You know, so being judgmental, resentful, you know, critical in a non-compassionate way. Those are dangers of this, right? It's very understandable. That's why I think, you know, when you actually can, it's valuable to study the life of someone like Dr. King. Pretty amazing. You know, you find him having, at least in speeches, and, you know, who knows what some of his private moments were like, but at least in his speeches and so forth, you find incredible empathy towards the people who are on the other side. Right? You don't find demonization, you don't find him being judgmental. You find him seemingly really having empathy and his quality of love with people who, a lot of whom, might want to kill him. That's pretty remarkable. So how, for us, maybe on a lesser scale, how do we keep integrity and not in those situations simply think we're better, judge them, get an attitude, etc. So mostly more sort of pointing out some of the challenges of integrity. I think that's some of what comes from the discussion, which is good to know, because if you're interested in this, you got to know what the challenges are. We know those. They came out. I think we all know this one, right? So it's just a matter of how can you keep on going with this, and it may be where is the part of my life where, you know, I'm being called in terms of integrity. Maybe it's the larger social world. Or maybe it's one speech, etc. Other reflections, questions, comments? Lucia, please.
I went to one of your day-longs out at Spirit Rock over the last year. And after the day-long, I came up and you were talking about social justice. And you made the statement that the Buddha didn't address social justice in his time.
Yeah.
And I was a little stunned because, you know, I was taken aback, I guess.
Yeah.
And tonight, when you discussed and talked about Western Buddhism, I
where does social justice fit in to Western Buddhism? And all the people I know, or at least many of the people I know who are practitioners, come from a background where social justice was part of a family value, it
yeah.
was part of community value. And yet, you know, as a practitioner, I can't ignore that.
That's right.
And then I think about what goes on in Burma and some of the southeastern countries that are largely Buddhist.
Yeah.
And the dichotomy that exists. Would you talk about that?
Say a few words, yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
So there are a lot of different themes that I could follow based on what you said. What I have found from both my study and from spending a fair amount of time in Asia with people who call themselves socially engaged Buddhists. First of all, there are, I've actually done some writing and published material on, the extent to which there are themes, something like that of justice in the teachings of the Buddha. And, one could make a case for there being different themes. There wasn't a concept that translates into our concept, the Western concept of justice, in Buddhist tradition. It's simply the concept isn't there. Still, you can see ways the Buddha within the community of monks and nuns wouldn't permit the caste system to exist. You could interpret that as something related to social justice. He made comments about how when there was poverty and some had more than others, it was the basis for social disharmony. Right? Those are comments. Those are, the point about having everyone there be in one community without caste, that's pretty significant. It was, and he made comments which were quite critical of the existing social relations of the time and got a lot of flack from what we hear. So that is there. There wasn't, once one joined the community, it was something which didn't have the caste system. Beyond that, there wasn't participation in the wider society. So some of what we have to deal with just wasn't there as a dimension of practice. So Western engaged Buddhists have tried to fill out the model, and a lot of my work has been trying to have there be ways of conscious practicing in the social realm, in one's work in the world, that are continuous with the inner practice. That's what my book is about, the engaged spiritual life. It's really laying out, I have 10 chapters and 10 different ways to bring that practice in. And some of what I've done personally, some of you know I've done about 15 years of basically organizing and mostly directing training programs for people engaged in the world to connect it with inner practice. So that's the kind of the field of experimentation, right? And colleagues around the world who are trying to do the same thing, who broadly come under the rubric of socially engaged Buddhism or sometimes engaged Buddhism. And there are people where people are trying to have ways of understanding how one's practice is, how to practice in the world be continuous with meditation. I think the principles are there. You could see some of what I said earlier makes it clear how that could happen, but there's a lot of need for creativity and innovation and development, right? We're at a pretty early stage in doing that. So I think that's how I hold it. So there is that possibility of moving in that direction, but it's at a young place, And any of us who engage in that, so Patty's being innovative and trying to integrate some perspectives regarding how we relate to non-human animals. I always like to say that because we're actually animals, And I always think of, there's the kind of beloved San Francisco poet, Michael McClure. Mm-hmm. he has a poem in which he talks continually about being, he says, I am a mammal patriot. So anyway, so you're being innovative and creative in certain ways. And I think all of us, if we stay connected and share what we're learning, we build a culture of integrity where we're doing this in all the spheres of our lives. So that's maybe a good way to close, to say that that's an aspiration, but there are tendencies where our practice can really just be more private and for our own peace. That's valuable, but it's limited.